Would you bow your heads with me this morning? God, we thank you for each person present this morning, as well as for all those who are often among us but are not here today for reasons of illness or travel or other needs. Bless us and them. We lay down now the concerns of the week, the pressures and worries that we often insist on carrying. We open our hearts. We invite your presence among us this morning. And ask you to speak to our condition, which you know well. In the name of Jesus, amen.
I don't know if any of you have ever edited a book of fiction before, but that's something that in my line of work as a publisher and editor, I sometimes get to do. Sometimes, because Barclay Press doesn't actually publish fiction, but every once in a while we have an editing project come along where even though we're not going to publish the book, I really want to work on it. And I actually just finished this last week. I've been working for a month with an author that I've never met. He's out of Texas, but writing a story that's based in Whitefish, Montana. And I did some editing for him. It was an editorial assessment is what he asked me to do. I ended up doing lots and lots of line edits, just interacting with the text. And what his story was missing, because once you get to page 44, the story just flowed. But what the story was missing in those first 43 pages was a point of entry. And for good fiction, that point of entry is almost always clear conflict, if there's a problem. And he had a mystery that really made the story just run once you got to page 44. Unfortunately, the mystery didn't make any sense for those first 43 pages. And so what I needed to do was to give him feedback that would help, instead of me trying to fix the problem for him, was to give him feedback that would help him to rethink his story so that he could figure out what is the mystery, because he knows what it is. He's the one who carries the story. He just had to find it. He needed to find an entry point so that readers would have a reason to read the whole book. A reason bigger than them just wanting to edit his work, which is what I wanted to do. In landscape photography, which is my personal hobby, in fact, I'm going to take a day off work tomorrow and go hike Umbrella Falls in Tillamook State Forest. You can get there. It's only a 3/4 mile hike, but I'm actually going to do a larger 8 mile loop so that I can kind of enjoy the forest and use it most of my morning while I'm there tomorrow, rain or shine. In landscape photography, an entry point is a little bit different. You're often looking for a visual line, a hook, that someone will see that will direct them. So for instance, if I'm taking a picture of Mount Hood, I might duck behind some trees and tilt the camera up just enough so that the branches and the tree trunks frame the mountain, that they kind of focus your attention where you're supposed to look. They give you a lens, so to speak. And I don't just mean that as a metaphor. I'm actually shooting the camera through a lens, but I'm also trying to create a kind of a frame that focuses your attention. Another way to focus somebody's attention to lead them into a photo might be to back up. I'm taking a picture of Mount Hood, and if there's a lake in front of it, but if I back up a little bit, I might be able to get this dead log that's lying along the beach that's kind of pointing, not directly at Mount Hood, but it leads your eye. So there's this visual line, this detail that's up front, and it's not the important detail, but it hooks you into the image, and then your eye kind of follows the log until you can see the majesty of that mountain above the water. I think that we as human beings, when we don't have that kind of a hook, when we don't know what the conflict is in the story, or we don't have a place to start in a photo, we can be overwhelmed. My brother and I have had this conversation when he's trying to clean the house that he and my dad are living in. He's often overwhelmed. where do I start? And the thing is, he could start anywhere. But if I tell him, oh, you could start anywhere, that doesn't actually help him. He needs a specific task that he can start on. And it needs to be small enough that he knows he can do it. That it's not going to be so much that, oh, what's the point? Because I don't know if any of you have ever had to clean a house, but it doesn't stay clean. It just doesn't. And so not only are you overwhelmed, like, where do I start? But what's the point? There's these multiple levels of obstacles that you have to overcome. And a hook helps us to move into whatever that tension is that we're facing. A hook can also help us move into whatever beauty it is that God has for us to experience. A hook can also help us to move into deeper understanding of a problem that otherwise is just a mystery. A hook can help us to enter into somebody else's story that otherwise is just confusing to us because it's so far outside of our own experience. Jesus often had people come to him looking for a hook. And sometimes those questions that they asked Jesus might have looked like trick questions. In fact, they might have even kind of been trick questions or traps. But sometimes Jesus' answer reveals that he is actually taking the question at face value. He's actually taking the question as a serious question, and he's offering a serious answer. And one of these questions has to do with, it's repeated in the three Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So we know that this question matters because all three of these writers put it right there in the center of the story where we're just bound to trip over it. This is a question, what am I supposed to do with the law and the prophets? Somebody comes to Jesus, sometimes it's an expert in the law, sometimes it's the Pharisees and the Sadducees, sometimes it is just a person identified as a lawyer, and they want to know, teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest? Now, we might read that as them looking for a loophole. What are all the laws that we're allowed to ignore? But I think a better way, maybe not the best way, but a better way to read this is someone looking for, well, there's so much. There's all the food regulations and all the regulations about the temple and all the regulations about hand washing. There are regulations about what kind of baldness is considered clean and unclean. There are regulations about what to do if you have a stain in a garment or what to do if you have mold in your house. There's so many regulations. Where am I supposed to start if I want to be a good person? And Jesus offers a hook. And this hook is not necessarily the only thing that matters. Instead, it's a starting point. If you want to live the right kind of life, here's where you start. And you might actually already know what it is that I'm going to read. This is Matthew 22, starting in verse 37. Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." This is the hook. And it's the hook for us, not so that we can ignore the Old Testament and just move on. Okay, got it, Jesus, I can do that. It's so that when we go back to the Old Testament, we have a starting point now. Anything that doesn't make sense to us, Jesus is saying, you can read it through this lens. Jesus actually offers several other hooks. For instance, he offers from the prophet Isaiah this prophecy about a year of jubilee when the whole world is going to experience justice. The blind will see, the lame will walk, the poor are going to be taken care of. That's another hook that Jesus offers. So he actually gives us several starting points, and we can pick one. But this is the one I want to focus on today. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus isn't just offering a lens through which to see the Hebrew Testament or the Old Testament. He's also actually referencing a place where we could go back and start. So if we want to understand the Old Testament, we can go back to where it says, love your neighbor as yourself. And we can start there. So that's what I want to do this morning. Leviticus 19, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18 is what Jesus was quoting. This is the hook that he gives us. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. This is the starting point. And it turns out that this phrase, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, doesn't just show up here in Leviticus, but this appears to be where Jesus is quoting from, because this chapter in Leviticus is also the one that defines a stranger, a foreigner, a poor person, as your neighbor. So when Jesus follows up that hook with the story of the Good Samaritan, it's kind of like he's giving us two clues that this might be the chapter he's pulling from, because this is the chapter that deals not only with love your neighbor as yourself, but oh, and by the way, that person who is foreign to you, they're your neighbor. That's who you're supposed to love. So I want to start at the beginning of this chapter that closes out in verse 18, not the end of the chapter, but the end of that particular section of teaching with love your neighbor as yourself. And I just want to go through these verses and demonstrate what happens to them when we read them through that lens. Because I think that these first 18 verses are all about neighbor love, are all about why community matters, why the other people who are here this morning and the people who aren't here this morning, why they matter, why all of us matter. So Leviticus 19, I'll start in verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 2, speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. That word holy is often interpreted, at least in Christian evangelical tradition, as a kind of perfection, of righteousness, of doing the right thing. Holy is a bigger word than that. Holy has the same root as whole, to be all one thing. And so to be holy is about being unified in your character, to have integrity. And it's about being unified as a community, that we would be one just as Jesus and the Father are one. To be a holy community is to be the same thing all the way through. What we say we believe and what we actually practice, that they would line up. How we say we want to be treated and how we treat other people, that they might line up too. Verse 3. You shall each revere your mother and father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. There are two things here, and mother and father are both specific, like I should actually respect my parents, but they're also a metaphor. I should respect those people who've gone before me, the people whose shoulders I'm standing on, the people whose community I am now a part of as well. I should respect those who've been before me and who are with me, who might mentor me and guide me and sometimes correct me. And you shall keep my Sabbaths. One of the most important things it appears to be, to me, in about neighbor love is remembering to rest, to remember to take time away. The reason I'm taking tomorrow off work and going on a hike up to University Falls and Tillamook State Forest is because I haven't had any days off work in the last 2 weeks. And not only is that not good for me, but this might not be true for you, I don't always treat people well when I'm tired. You laugh. It can be hard for me. Maybe it's not hard for you. Rest is good for me. It's good for my body. It's good for my brain. It's good for my emotions. But when I remember to rest, it makes me better to the other people around me. When I rest, it's good for my whole community. When we rest, it's good for all of us. Do not turn to idols or make cast images for yourselves. I am the Lord your God. This verse 4, is one that out of context I read as I'm not supposed to worship idols. But in the context of neighbor love, I'm not supposed to be distracted. If we are all one community focused on serving God together, then anything that pulls me away potentially takes me out of community. Anything that pulls me away from God potentially takes me away from you. And so an idol isn't just some other religion or some other thing in my life that I might want to worship beside God. An idol is anything that takes me away from the people that God has put me into community with. It separates me. And so I might think in my own life, what are the things that make it hard for me to be present to others, other than just not being rested enough? And I know, because I had my little sister Bethany and her boyfriend over for dinner last night, that sometimes my phone is that thing. My phone is not an idol, I don't worship it, but sometimes it makes it hard for me to be present. I know that my ego is sometimes that thing. I don't worship myself, but sometimes my need to be right or my need to not look bad keeps me from being vulnerable, let alone humble. So an idol is not necessarily just a graven image. It's not necessarily just some other religious practice. It's not necessarily a thing that I worship. I think that in context of neighbor love, if that's the hook that I'm using for reading this, an idol might be anything that pulls me away from people that I'm supposed to be loving. Verses 5 through 8. When you offer a sacrifice of well-being to the Lord, offer it in such a way that it is acceptable in your behalf. It shall be eaten on the same day you offer it, or on the next day. And anything left over until the third day shall be consumed in fire. If it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an abomination, it will not be acceptable. All who eat it shall be subject to punishment, because they have profaned what is holy to the Lord, and any such person shall be cut off from the people. This is actually a little bit hard to read in the context of neighbor love. And so I'm going to play with this a little bit, and then I'm going to move on, because I'm not quite sure what to do with this one. But the way that that I understand a sacrifice of well-being is that it's usually a food offering. It might actually be in the form of a live animal, so it's very fresh food. And that animal is sacrificed and then cooked. And the aroma of the animal cooking is supposed to please God. And I think it pleases God to see us getting ready to eat together. I think that it makes God happy to see us getting ready to enjoy ourselves in community. I think that when we host a potluck here, that is this kind of sacrifice. I think that when we go to one another's homes and share a meal, that's this kind of sacrifice. And when I invite people over to my home, I might be tempted to pull something out of the fridge or out from under the counter that's been sitting there for 3 days that I don't want to eat. And I don't know if any of you have done this with canned food drives, where it's like, the beets can go. Especially pickled beets. Actually, I like pickled beets. Never mind. We're going to keep those. I prefer daikon, though. That's because it's a little bit sweet and it's really good in sandwiches. But I think that might be this kind of sacrifice. That in community, we don't serve rotten food to each other. And we don't eat rotten food. It's bad for our body, and it does not communicate love to our neighbor. So I know that this is probably bigger than just that, but reading it through the lens of neighbor love, I think that the intent here is that God wants us to enjoy being in community, and that means that we serve one another our best, that we actually celebrate one another. Verses 9 and 10. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not strip your vineyard bare or gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. In the context of neighbor love, I think this one's pretty obvious. People who have less, we make space for them to be in our community, and we make space for them to flourish as well. They don't have to sit outside while we enjoy a meal together. If someone cannot afford the time or the resources to make a meal for the potluck, they still get to eat. They still get to sit down with us at the table because they are us and we are them. We might not have our own vineyards or grain fields, but we know what it is to make space for people in our community. We have extra chairs here. We're making space in our community for people to be with us. Verses 11 and 12. You shall not steal, you shall not deal falsely, and you shall not lie to one another. And you shall not swear falsely by my name, profaning the name of your God. I am the Lord. In the context of neighbor love, when we take advantage of one another, that destroys community because it destroys trust. And someone might say, I like Eric, but I don't really trust him. It's hard for anybody to be vulnerable, to actually experience safety. Because even if Eric never makes that mistake again, people are still going to be skeptical. And rightfully so. And so we shouldn't steal from each other. We shouldn't deal falsely with one another. We shouldn't lie to each other. And we definitely shouldn't drag God into whatever it is that we're trying to make somebody else believe. That is to profane God's name. Because God just wants us, in the context of neighbor love, to love each other. To love each other in community. Verses 13 through 16. You shall not defraud your neighbor. You shall not steal, and you shall not keep for yourself the wages of a laborer until morning. You shall not revile the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. You shall not render an unjust judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. With justice you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not profit by the blood of your neighbor. I am the Lord. The way that we interact with the larger community, those people who are not necessarily here at Silverton Friends Church, it actually affects not just our witness, it affects our character. It shapes who we are. And so it's not just up to us to be kind to the people who are here. We're also supposed to treat with integrity the people that we interact with on a daily basis, no matter what they believe, no matter where they live, no matter their skin color or language. We are not supposed to hold off on paying the wages of a laborer until the next morning, especially if it's a day laborer who is depending on those wages to feed their family. We are supposed to do everything within our power to be better than whatever it is that the culture in which we live is saying is good enough. We're supposed to take care of people. We shouldn't be ableist. We shouldn't revile the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind. And this isn't just about physical accessibility. I think it's also about maybe the way that we schedule events. Are we making it easy for people to come and be part of whatever it is that we're doing? 2 weeks ago, actually I guess a week ago Saturday, we spent a lot of time thinking about, actually not we, Pam and others who are cooking spent a lot of time thinking about people who had special diets. That's a way that we avoid putting a stumbling block in front of people. We make it easier for everybody to partake. Verses 17 and 18, and this is the end of the section that I've been wanting to look at. You shall not hate in your heart anyone of your kin. Kin being short for kind or kindred. So this is people like us, people that we're related to, but we might extend it to humanity. We might. You shall reprove your neighbor, or you will incur guilt yourself. This is a hard teaching, and I want to come back to that, but first, verse 18, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people, but you shall, and here's the teaching, love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. This, you shall not hate in your heart anyone of your kin, you shall reprove your neighbor. This is something that actually has been a little bit of a theological puzzle for a long time. In fact, Jesus deals with this specific puzzle in Matthew 18, where he talks about the way that we are to confront someone who's wronged us. And it turns out that Jesus' interpretation of this passage is pretty common among rabbis going back, or teachers in Jewish tradition, going back for thousands of years. They understood this as a teaching about what to do when someone else in your community or in your family harms you. And that harm might be gossip or slander. That harm might be physical harm. The harm might be neglect or isolation, where you feel like someone didn't include you or didn't care to include you. That harm might be to your reputation. There's all kinds of ways that we can be harmed. In fact, the closer you are to someone, the more potential there is for friction with that person. The closer you are to someone, the more vulnerable you are to them. And so this is a pretty important teaching in the context of neighbor love. If someone harms us, how do we go on being a community? And Jesus recommends, in his interpretation of what it means to reprove someone, Jesus recommends that you go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. That you tell the person in honesty, this is what happened, this is how that felt. And you don't necessarily have to do it in front of everyone in order to win a point. If we're in community, and if we're in a trusting community, then the hope is that you could actually go to that person and talk to them. Now, because of power dynamics, and because of the way that culture works, this doesn't always work. But the intent of this teaching, the intent of Jesus' interpretation of this teaching seems to be that if you can, you figure out a way to initiate a conversation. You figure out a way to start talking. And if any of you have been in a close relationship with a child, a parent, a partner, then you've experienced this most likely. And sometimes it's easier to just avoid talking about it, but long term, that ends up not being real good for the relationship. And in fact, sometimes the struggle is to figure out how to bring it up. Like, how are we going to talk about this? And this is actually something that we make memes about, because everyone knows that at Thanksgiving, that's when you're supposed to have the awkward discussions with members of your family that you'd rather not talk to at all. That this is actually a holiday in which we make fun of it, but it's a holiday of reconciliation. And this is what I think Jesus is talking about. Reconciliation doesn't happen unless somebody initiates. And often, unfortunately, it's on the person who's been harmed to say, that hurt me. And saying that hurt me doesn't mean that the other person's going to take you seriously. If that person listens to you, according to Jesus in Matthew 18, you have regained them. If they listen to you, the community can continue. Some healing has taken place. The harm is not undone, but you can start over again because they've taken you seriously. They heard you. They understood, oh, I did hurt you. I'm not going to do that again. But if you're not listened to, take one or two others along with you. Some witnesses. Some backup. And again, Jesus does not seem to be saying, now you get to blast them. Instead, he's saying, try again. So that every word may be confirmed, they're not going to be able to gaslight you. They're not going to be able to say, no, that's not what she said, because you'll have witnesses with you. And if they still refuse to listen, then go ahead and tell the community. Go ahead and raise it to the next level. This is a problem for us. This person and I aren't able to talk right now about the hurt that I experienced, and I think that that's going to harm the whole community, because it does. The interpersonal is also communal. That when there's an unspoken hurt between two people, it can very slowly infect all the ways that we interact with each other, all the ways that we talk to each other. And if it's not resolved, it can be passed on generation to generation. I know that that kind of thing has happened in my family. I think it can also happen in churches. That things that don't get resolved continue to show up in weird ways. The patterns of communication just keep repeating themselves. And sometimes we might find ourselves in a conflict, we don't even know how it started, because it was before we were born or before we were here. Jesus isn't the only rabbi that interprets this process. And I actually did just a little bit of research. I say just a little because I actually stumbled across a thread from Rabbi Daniel Ruttenberg, who is awesome. And she had specifically, I did a search actually, and she had specifically been dealing with this passage from Leviticus. And she's quoting from a number of no longer alive rabbinical scholars from way back when. And one of them, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name, Maimonides, he makes it clear that this process in Leviticus is set out there because if the community is going to be healthy, the victim, the victim, for their own emotional health, needs to be able to put into words, "You hurt me." The victim needs to be able to put that into words, because if they hold it inside them, if you hold the hurt inside you, this is his theory, then you carry it with you everywhere you go in the community. And it makes it hard for you to be present to people, especially if it feels like everyone knows the hurt that you experienced and nobody's willing to say anything or do anything about it. They might not actually know, but there is that feeling. And it to have to carry around that hurt and resentment without any opportunity for resolution, it's not good for you. Maimonides said, "One sinned against shouldn't remain in silent hate. Make harm known to them and say, 'Why have you done to me thing? Why did you sin against me in that matter?'" Rabbi Daniel Ruttenberg says, notably, this is a question, but one that makes it clear that the action and impact were harmful. "You did this harmful thing to me. Why?" Not that intent is more important, but it opens a space for a conversation. Rabbi Daniel Ruttenberg points out that you can't always do this. Power dynamics, cultural defaults, but that if you can start that conversation, there's a potential that the whole community could be healed by the risk that you take. I could go on because she has a lot more words about that, but I just want us to think about not just this particular passage, but the fact that Jesus often offers us hooks or lenses that we can take back to the Old Testament in order to kind of revision, rethink, re-see what is it that God is trying to do in us? What might God want to say to me personally or to us communally through the Old Testament, the Hebrew Testament? And then I also want to repeat this point. That if we want to be the people that God is calling us to be, both as individuals and as a community, then we have to learn not only to love God with all our hearts and with all our souls and with all our mind, but also to love our neighbors as ourselves.
This has been a rich and challenging morning for me, from our music to our preaching, and I'm so grateful for both of those. Often when we list things, we put the most important first. So we should first love God and love our neighbors as ourselves. And I don't know if that's a cultural thing or if it's always been that way, if it's just a human thing. But Jesus seems to caution us in several places in Scripture. He says, if you bring your offering to the altar, in other words, if you want to tell God how much you love him, but you're not right with your brother or sister, leave your offering and go take care of the other. And in another place, if you can't love your neighbor who you have seen, how can you love God who you haven't seen? So it may be that loving our neighbor is the best possible way to love God. So I'd invite you all to reflect on what we've heard, what we've sung this morning, to be a blessing to each other and to the community where we live and the people that we know, and to go from this place in peace. Good morning.